Well, you know, a really bad decision is to keep a war going for 500 years.
Well, yeah. Of course. I mean, that's what happened in...
A Taste of Armageddon.
Yeah, and thank God we only got just a taste of it.
You didn't like this episode.
I can't say I liked or didn't like this episode. It was kind of just one of those episodes that just kind of happens.
Well, I'm really sad to hear you say that. I like this episode a lot.
Okay, and I can see why people would. It's just there was nothing to it. It was like one of those songs that doesn't really have a chorus, so there's nothing that gets stuck in your head. And it's like, I enjoyed listening to it at the time enough. It's just I can't sing it to myself, and I would never listen to it again.
See, I was really hoping by this point in the experiment that you would be able to enjoy this episode, and I'm going to tell you exactly why. Because you're right. Really, this episode doesn't have a lot of plot. Like, the setup happens in the first 10 minutes. The secret, you know, of the thing is unveiled, where they're waging a war by computers, and you know, the casualties are going into these booths, and they're basically committing suicide.
Yes.
Right? And that, you know, in another episode, you can see another episode of the show where that would have been the big reveal at the end.
Yeah.
But they dispense with all that. In, like, the first 10 minutes, you totally find that out. And if you're familiar with Star Trek at all, I think you can see the end where the end of the episode is going to go. And so the fun is just seeing how they get there. And I guess I was hoping that by this point you would be able to have fun seeing how they get there.
No, I mean, and that was fine. And it was interesting seeing all of that. It's more, it just thematically felt very slight. I mean, I'm finding I like Star Trek a lot more when it's about something.
Well, this was about something, though.
Yes, that we shouldn't have war because it's really destructive, and even a clean version of war is bad, but...
Well, I think,
it took too many steps to get there.
No, I think you're missing the point.
Okay.
I think the point is not that war is bad, because, come on, we all know that. The point is that we don't have constant warfare because war is extremely destructive. So you have to look at it under the surface. We don't do a lot of things because they have unintended consequences or intended consequences, right?
Yes, of course.
And the fact of this society, or these two societies really, waging this, you know, 5-century-long war, this very clean war, you know, the computer models, oh, they're attacking and bombs are going down, and the computer is modeling casualties and it marks people as fatalities in this attack. And then you just go off into these booths and you are killed. That's all well and good. And that's an interesting setup for an episode. But I think, you know, at the very end of it, you really see the core of what this is supposed to be demonstrating to you, which is that, you know, you can't sanitize things. Like, there's a reason certain things are terrible. There's a reason certain things are dirty. And to try and make them more palatable or to try and make them better is dangerous. And you may not even realize that it's dangerous. And you get so far down this rabbit hole that you don't even know that what you're doing is doing the same thing that you're trying to avoid. Because by them, you know, by them doing this kind of warfare, by waging war in this way, they have in effect totally destroyed their society, and they don't even realize it. And I think that's kind of the amazing thing about the episode.
Okay, fair enough. And I mean, I agree with that definitely. And they have abstracted war very much. I mean, it's painless. At the same, I mean, Let's set aside the question of if they are killing these many people, like, that would devastate society as it is. I mean, that's no less devastation, except the only thing you don't have is collateral damage or physical damage, but you do still have the same amount of casualties you would have anyway.
I mean, the entire point of it, I think, was, like, you know, they were talking about fusion bombs, and we all know how destructive just normal nuclear fission bombs are. And so, we don't have... Do we have fusion bombs? I don't know. I feel like I should know this.
I feel...
We don't have fusion bombs.
I remember, like... See, what I can tell you, like, stuff I learned from when I was a kid. We have fish...
We have hydrogen bombs.
We have fission, but not fusion.
Yeah.
But again, that was 20 years ago. I don't know what changes happened. I have a feeling we would have heard if we had nuclear fusion by now.
Yeah, I think. Well, we have. I think we could. No, we can do nuclear fusion. I think it's just. Can we? I don't know.
I
we're going to get letters about this or something. But yeah. We're like, you guys don't know that we don't have nuclear fusion. What's going on here?
I'm sorry. I'm a musician who studied literature in college.
And I haven't been to school in years. And the last time I was in school, it was for library science. So yeah. Suck it. And now I don't remember what I was saying.
They have fusion bombs.
Right. And so, you know, the idea, of course, is that fusion bombs would like totally just like vaporize a whole city.
Yeah.
And you wouldn't just lose the people, right? You would lose all the buildings. You would lose the cities. You would lose the art. You would lose the culture. You would lose the factories, food production. You would lose all of this stuff. And I think there's this idea that, yes, having warfare waged in this way where just the people are being killed would be disruptive, but you can adapt to that, which I think is the more insidious part of the episode. Like if you, it's like shrinkage in retail. You factor it in. And
okay, fair enough.
So maybe, you know, they just have more children to compensate.
Okay. Well, I mean, that makes fair from a logical standpoint. I'm trying to think, because it would be easier if I could explain it, because it's not like I didn't like the episode. And there were some, you know, excellent moments here. You know, Scotty has a lot to do in this episode. And, you know, last week's, I said, you know, in the Khan episode, there were a lot of moments where you had, like, Uhura and Bones both, like, showing that they're tough. And here you have Scotty directly disobeying an order because he recognizes how wrong this order is. At one point, the ambassador says, well, we can trust these people. Hooray. You know, and Scotty's like, no, that's like, just, I don't care what the consequences are. Any consequence that I can get from, you know, being court-martialed is not going to be as bad as if I actually follow this order. Like, he considers the risk, and he, and that takes guts from Scotty as well.
Well, I think there's two things there, right? Like, I think it's interesting that you say that he's doing the right thing by not disobeying the order to completely destroy the planet. Like,
No, the one from the ambassador.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's what the ambassador was telling him.
Yeah.
Like, not to do that.
No, I thought he was saying simply just to raise the shields. And this was earlier. He's saying, raise the shields. We're going to go down to the planet. We're going to be okay.
No, the ambassador didn't want him to carry out his orders. Like, he told him not to do that. And he did tell him also, like, don't lower the shields. But Scotty knew that by lowering the shields, they would be destroyed and he wouldn't be able to carry out the explicit orders that Kirk gave him. So it's one of those things where it's like, on the one hand, Scotty was protecting the 450 crew members of the Enterprise, but on the other hand, in a darker way, he didn't want to do it because not only did he want to keep the Enterprise around, he wanted to carry out the orders from Kirk. I mean, and I think that's kind of weird. Like, I think it's strange.
I don't know how. I think you're misinterpreting something, because when you say wanted to carry out the orders, I think you take that kind of implies a bit more joy in taking this order. It's not so much like that Scotty explicitly wanted to. I don't think Scotty woke up that day and said, God damn, I hope I can destroy a planet today. I mean, I've never really seen the power of this ship to destroy a planet, and I hope no. I mean, it's partial. I think
in season two.
Yeah, that's true. I think there is he explicitly does say, no, you know, I'm following what my captain says, you know, and all of that. And yes, definitely he has loyalty to the captain. At the same time, I think Scotty recognizes a trap. I mean, in this episode, the ambassador is seen as extremely naive. I believe it's Scotty explicitly says, look, these people attacked us with heat waves. They impersonated the captain and lied to us. You know, they're doing all these things. And now they say, oh, we're friends now. Sorry, big misunderstanding. And you're trusting them. I mean, they tell that. And the ambassador is like, see, it worked. Diplomacy, you know, hooray. And, you know, Scotty realizes, dude, this is a trap. The second we lower those shields, you know, there is no reason that they're not going to immediately attack us. I think that's more of his motivation there.
Okay, I can see that. I mean, I definitely, you know, am coming around to that interpretation. But I think as well, like there's definitely a desire on his part to follow Kirk's orders, and yeah. because he respects Kirk.
But that's it; and, he trusts what Kirk.
Right.
Kirk is not going, and at the same time, I mean, if Kirk just went bloodthirsty and got pissed off at these people for no reason and said, "All right, destroy the planet," I think in that case we might have even seen Scotty disobey Kirk. We have seen people disobey Kirk before, and it's always for a good reason. But for the most part, we've always – and Kirk, every time someone has disobeyed him, he's recognized the relationship of trust that he has with them and has said, all right, this person is disobeying me for a good reason. They're not just doing it for the hell of it. You know, nobody mutinies in Star Trek without meaning it. And
right.
I think Scotty basically says, well, if Kirk says destroy this planet, he has a goddamn good reason for me to destroy this planet. So, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, I think you're right. And I think, you know, and I think the other thing you can take away from this as well is that, you know, in a lot of ways, this is really Scotty's episode. Like, I think in this episode, more than any of the others that we've seen so far, you really get a good sense. I mean, yeah, Scotty has always been portrayed as an excellent engineer, yeah. and you know, keeps the ship in order and keeps the engines going and all of that stuff, and he's definitely been shown to be an intelligent man, but you kind of see a little bit more of, you know, Scotty behind the curtain as it is,
yeah,
like, you know, what he's really made of when he's left in command, because he immediately picks up on the fact that Kirk's voice is being impersonated,
yeah.
and runs it through the computer, and 30 seconds later he's like, yep, yeah, I was right. You know, and it's like those little things where you gotta go, oh yeah, okay, Scotty is, yeah, it's smarter than I thought he was, maybe. And of course, you know, I know that Scotty is very smart
because, yeah.
I've seen the show before, but you may not. So,
well, then they'd go out of their way to make him more than just a geek who knows the machine. I mean, I've seen plenty of shows where they have that kind of character, and they usually treat the tech character as one who's comfortable talking about computers or machinery or whatever, but has trouble relating to people. I mean, that's one of those, you know, cliches that TV and movies do a lot.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
The fact that, again, he recognizes this voice is being faked, you know, there's a good reason. You know, he's very socially savvy, too, so.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true.
That's before, yeah, I don't know.
I think the other thing that we can mention about the ambassador before we move on to something else is I really want his outfit.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
I think it's amazing. Like, he's got this, like, huge collar thing that just looks like, I don't know, like he's wearing a hula hoop around his neck or something. And it's amazing, and I want one.
I have to say, every single outfit in this show looks comfortable as hell. The that one dress that the main woman in the episode has, it's just basically like, I mean, it's almost like a sarong. It's just this drape, like, curtain around her, and she's just like, just, I mean, it looks awesome on her, but it looks just like super comfortable.
There's a really funny slash depressing story about the uniforms. That the show had to be so careful with their budget,
yeah.
that they couldn't afford to have the uniforms made by the union tailors or seamstresses or whatever it was, and so they had to have them done in some sweatshop in LA, and then they like smuggled them in through a window or something.
What?
Yeah, it's nuts. Like, there's all these like background things that you just would not expect from Star Trek. It's really weird.
Huh, I did not know that.
Now you do.
Well, then I can tell my friends at parties.
So what do you think about the very end of the episode? Because I kind of drew a comparison in my mind between Kirk's speech about the violent nature of humanity or whatever the species is, and you know, something like drug abuse or alcoholism, because he really did make it sound like, you know, an addiction that you have to fight. And yes, we're all violent, we all have these tendencies, but you have to fight against them and rise against them.
Yeah,
and,
it says
and
we
not,
can kill,
not indulge.
But we can decide that, yes, we're killers, but we're not going to kill today. And, you know, we're not going to do this today. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't say it's so much. I wouldn't say it's so much an alcoholism metaphor, although I can definitely see where that's going. I think it's more of a – I mean, there's – this is something that personally, you know, offends me in society when, you know, that whole, oh, everyone's a little bit racist thing. No, that's fucking bullshit, you goddamn idiot. No, you're just a racist motherfucker, and go fucking kill yourself. If that's how you feel, if you feel that humanity has this racist name and then you're fucking shit. No, you can transcend.
And we now lost our clean tag.
Ugh. You can transcend that. You can be better than that. And I think that that is the point of this episode, that, you know, humanity is not a bunch of animals dealing with their instinct, that there is higher stuff in culture that we need to bring out, and we need to make that choice to be better. I mean, morality is a choice every day. Where I disagree with him is how it almost seems that the violence is the default. I personally philosophically think that we have the choice between good and evil at every moment, and it's not an inherent nature to be one or the other.
To be good or evil.
Allowing those labels to apply for the sake of this discussion. Yes.
I mean, if you subscribe to the theory that what is the line? It's like conscience is, or morality is what you do when no one is looking, or something like
character
that.
Character is what
character
you do.
Character is what,
yeah.
So I guess in that sense, I agree with you. But at the same time, I don't think that you can really argue that humanity on the whole is fairly violent.
But at the same time,
and that's something that is very, very common throughout most human societies.
Of course. I mean, the existence of war is a thing. I mean, humanity is territorial to the point where we have the ability to destroy the planet many times over just because of territory disputes. I mean, we're a species who says, if you take my territory, we're going to fucking destroy it all. Like, that is something that we as a species have in us.
Yeah.
At the same time,
which I think is more abstracted though, right? Because, well, you know, I don't want to get into like a whole like Jared Diamond, like talk about, you know, anthropology for 10 minutes or whatever, but
isn't that why people are coming to hear?
But no, I think, you know, because we don't really ever get a sense of, you know, just to ground this into the episode, we don't ever really get a sense of what the war was even about. It was just sort of like, yes, they were a colony of ours that broke away, and now they're our hated enemy, and you know, for what reason, it's never said. I mean,
to be fair, after 500 years, there probably isn't a single person, you know, everyday person who knows even what the war is about. Probably the only people who are aware of the causes and the reasons and even anything about the other species are probably more historians and anthropologists. Like, the average citizen of this planet doesn't even care. They just know we've always been at war with Eurasia. Or
it's just kind of like, I mean, you could even say that, you know, when he's talking about destroying the culture of, and this preserves our culture and everything like that. I think you can make the argument that, and maybe I am making the argument, that this has become part of their culture, right?
Yes.
And,
oh, fair.
You know, by destroying the computers that wage war, you know, Kirk is not destroying their culture, but he's definitely modifying it.
Well,
to the better, probably, because at the end of the episode, we're left with the hope that they will... the ambassador is left behind or agrees to be left behind, and the hope is that they will, you know, stop the war and have peace again. So
yeah.
I don't think that's a bad thing, but you know, where the sort of like violent tendency comes into play, I think, is, you know, in the idea that yes, humans are violent, but they're more often than not violent for a reason, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's not just this sort of like, I feel like killing someone today kind of thing. You know, most wars are at least ostensibly about resources or food or something like that.
But at the same time, compared to, well, I mean, let's look at animals. Animals kill for food and self-defense, and that's why they do that. Humanity is one of the few species that... there are members who kill for fun. World War I was not over resources or really territory disputes or anything like that. pretty much everybody agrees, especially at the time, World War One was over nothing. Mm-hmm. It just kind of happened. I mean, I kind of figured that this war was a meaningless war similar to that, where it was just a bunch of just random incidents that just began a pissing contest, and eventually nobody felt that they could back down. So, I mean, yeah, that maybe that is a darker impulse. Maybe that does exist. But keep this in mind, view this in the light of the arena, which at the end explicitly says, look, you're a violent species, but you can be better. I mean, we're supposed to view this as an anthology series, but this is a Kirk who has already been told by a powerful being, look, your species can be better than this. Maybe you aren't just completely barbarians. I mean, he didn't get this lesson from out of the air. That experience could have taught him this for this one.
Yeah. I mean, I think there definitely, is a sense in the show that Kirk thinks of violence as a last resort.
Of course.
And I don't really think that we've ever seen Kirk just blatantly try and destroy a ship or a person or a planet for no reason. I mean, you know, maybe the closest he ever got was Arena. But then again, they did destroy a colony and kill a lot of people. So yeah, probably not. Or the Romulans, perhaps, in Balance of Terror. Maybe that's a better example because, yes, I think that fits into your idea of a pissing contest much more, where they had the memory of this horrible war from 100 years ago, but no one alive really remembered it or experienced it. And the only thing that they were doing now is they were coming over and destroying these listening posts and, you know, yes, killing one or two people at each listening post. But at the end of the day, is it really worth it to destroy a ship and possibly start another interstellar war than it would be to, you know, send some ambassadors to the Romulan Empire?
Well, that also informs this episode, too. Again, pretend that there's continuity here. The 2012 version of this show would have this Kirk informed by that experience.
No, that's definitely true. Yeah.
I also think it's very interesting to compare the ending of this to the ending of the Landru one. What was that one? The Archons.
Yeah, Return of the Archons.
Same. You have a culture which is stagnated because of a computer, and which has kept things in a certain stasis. And Kirk is the outside disrupting force, which says the stasis is wrong, and here's a better solution.
Yeah, yeah. And it's not even that I think Kirk thinks that that's like, you know, what is the noun form of that? Stasis? Like
static? Stagnation?
Stagnation.
Well, stasis and stagnation are two different
things. Yeah, it's not that he thinks that like being in stasis or stagnation is necessarily a bad thing, I guess, but definitely when it is as legitimately horrific as the war in A Taste of Armageddon, this is a bad thing. And I don't think that we're ever on the side of the war mongers.
No.
Or whatever they are.
No, I mean, and we do agree that there does need to be some kind of peace at the end. And the way he figures, it is interesting that he gives them peace by giving them complete and utter war.
Yeah.
And also, Let's go back to, this is 1966. We are in a Cold War with Russia at this point in history, where, what was the keyword? Mutually assured destruction. He's explicitly saying, look, these people are as scared of an all-out war as you are. They want this as little as you do. Like, they want to live their lives. You want to live their lives. What's figure something out.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, he calls their bluff, basically. Yeah. And then there's one thing we know, Kirk likes calling bluffs. So yeah, that's definitely true. Finally, I want to mention the yeoman. I don't remember her name, but she is awesome.
Yeah.
She's just like, when they put her in the room with the guy, and I think, was it Kirk or was it Spock? I don't remember.
Kirk,
but was it Kirk? Or I think it was maybe Spock. Anyway, it doesn't really matter.
It was Bones.
Leaves her in the room. Sure. Yeah, it was Bones. Leaves her in the room, and he's just like, do not let this guy up. And she's like, this look on her face. Like this is the most serious she has ever taken anything ever, and she is not going to fuck this up. Like, yeah. She's like ready to just like, if that guy moves, Like, if he says anything, she's just going to go over there and, like, punch him in the face.
Well, you know, she's a yeoman. This is probably, like, her first, like, real side quest.
Yeah.
So she's, like, this is the first time she's really probably been put in charge. And she is going to show them that, you know, she's getting a she knows she's up for a promotion and she's getting it after this, goddammit. She's going to be a senior yeoman. And if... I had one actually problem with this episode, by the way. Spock's apparently magic now.
What do you mean?
Because they're in the room and Kirk's all, well, Spock, do this. He's like, well, as a Vulcan, I have magical telepathy powers. And he, like, telepathies the guard into, like, coming. Why haven't they used this? Why aren't they just using this at every time? If Spock can just put thoughts in people's head, that's the most useful thing. And I have the odd feeling this is probably going to be the only time he distance telepathizes someone.
Well, my feeling is yes, that is correct. But it's not the first time that they mentioned that he has telepathic powers, of course, because mind meld from a previous episode. So they did mention that before. Those sorts of things are just, I mean, the fact that they're still calling him a Vulcanian in random episodes, even at this late point in the season, just goes to show you that, you know, things are still in flux. They don't know exactly what's going on.
To get out of there and figured, oh, we have an alien, we can do a cool alien power. Like, I get that.
I think that was a lot of it. Is it, he's an alien, we can give him whatever we need for this week.
Yeah.
And yes, it becomes a lot more constricted, you know, later on. But for now, they still kind of play around with that a little bit.
It's just interesting to see how, again, this would have been in the Bible. If this would have been written later.
All right. So how many tribbles would you give this episode?
I was originally going to give it a 5 tribbles, but you've convinced me to give it a 6 tribble.
Yes. Episode. Finally, I modified one of your scores.
Or did you? Am I just lying?
Don't say that. I'm sad now.
No, really, you did.
Okay, good. I like this episode. It gets an 8.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, the other episode I thought was wonderful.
Okay.
This Side of Paradise, I really liked it.
All right. Why?
Because...
Not to say that I don't like it, but you apparently... Like, if I like it, you know, this much, you like it this much.
Okay. I think it's... Eric made even, like, little, like, arm gestures. It was great. I think this is one of those episodes that reminds me of... It's kind of what's going on in Mad Men, but happening at this time. This is the old guard admitting that it's scared shitless of the counterculture and that it doesn't know what to do, but that it thinks the counterculture is wrong because it's changing things. And yet it doesn't really have a reason because it just thinks it's not the right way. It's kind of creepy and it's not what humanity should be. Here we have a colony that is 100% in order with the natural world. You have this radiation from space, which is normally harmful, but you have the local fauna has adapted to it. It has managed to...
It's not local fauna, though.
No?
There was a line in the episode...
Local flora, sorry. I'm sorry. The
No, I mean, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I'm not talking about flora fauna. I'm talking about the fact that McCoy, I think, says at one point that it came from space.
Okay, so you have...
If I can interject for a second, mm-hmm. I think, you know, I can kind of see where you're going.
And yeah.
I'm going to let you continue. But just think about this. The flora that allows them to be in tune with this planet's nature is a foreign object. Continue.
Which I don't think I actually don't think that contradicts where I'm going with.
Oh,
this.
I don't think it does either. But I just wanted you.
Okay,
to,
no.
I don't think you were making that connection, so I wanted to make it for you. But
okay,
but continue.
Thank you. That's fine. So you have this planet, which the implication that is then that it would be completely lifeless. You have because everything is apparently getting killed by this these radiation rays.
Animals would be, yeah.
Yes. So you have this plant which is not only able to survive in it, but thrives in it, which is adapted to it that it uses this radiation as energy. And then you have these humans coming to this planet who have managed to use this plant not only to survive on this planet, but to thrive even further. Every single person you see here is in perfect health. I mean, the things that Kirk is freaking out about are really strange. He's saying, well, they don't have animals. What are they eating? Well, they're vegan. Oh, shit. It's a vegan planet. Oh, no. Well, they could be planting more stuff, but they're only planting enough to sustain themselves. Shit. They're not trying to overextend their environmental impact and waste on this planet. Like, you have literally a group of people who have found a way for humanity to be natural. I mean, there is... It's not my personal philosophy to say that, you know, we should be in nature. I live in a city. That being said, there are plenty of people who believe that, no, humans are an animal. And, you know, we must live with respect and in harmony with nature. You have a group of people who have this ideal and who have managed to practice it.
And there's, I mean, you know, not to go off on a side tangent, but, you know, your idea that, you know, if you live in a city, you're not in tune with nature, I think is something that, you know, could be construed as incorrect because of course. You know, I think the most environmentally damaging thing that you can do is live in the suburbs.
Yeah,
so,
well.
you know, if you cities are a way for people to have, a civilization and a culture, and keep it, you know, mostly contained to small areas. And that's what you see for most of human society.
Yeah.
But anyway.
And we also agree that, I mean, like an anthill isn't part of the natural world. So from a non-human point of view, New York City is part of the natural world.
Yeah.
But anyway, the point is they, you know, the
anything found on the earth is part of the natural world by some definition. So
we have used other resources to build other things. I mean, that's fine.
You could go down this, you know, thing all day, but.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's an interesting read on the episode, and it's not something that I'd considered before.
Now,
I just wanted to say. I mean, I think, I've seen this episode, three or four times before, and I've never really cared for it. I mean, it's okay. It's like an average episode. It's got some nice character moments, and I just don't really like it all that much. I mean, it's fine, but it's not really one that I sit down. If I'm going to watch a Star Trek episode. I'm not going to sit down and watch this one. And I think a large part of it is the fact that I don't really buy the whole Spock love interest thing that's going on, but we can get to that later. Just, you know, but the way that you're reading this episode, I think is really interesting and it's making me think about it in a new way.
Huh.
I don't know that I like it anymore.
No,
but
and
it does give it some more intellectual heft than perhaps I didn't give it credit for having. Yeah. So,
well, let's talk about this.
Bravo to you, Richard.
Thank you. Let's talk about this Spock love thing because I have to say that I mean I thought the episode was really pretty because it's an outdoor location. Anytime the show uses outdoor, it's a very significant. And they pick there's all these green trees and this farm and the sprawling meadows, and it's really pretty.
I actually really like the way that this show uses outdoor locations because when they use them, which is infrequently, you get a lot of them, and it's nice to get that breathing room. It's nice to get that break. And they don't do it all the time because, of course, location shooting is expensive.
Yeah.
And they have a lot of episodes that take place on the Enterprise or, you know, another small ship or, you know, in a room in a colony or whatever for budgetary reasons. But yeah, you're right. When they go outside, they really do a nice job with it.
So you have this scene when Spock is in the meadow with this woman and, you know, they're talking and he's Spock. And then she takes him to this flower, it sneezes on him, he goes through these convulsions.
Doesn't sneeze on him, it jizzes on him.
Well,
but anyway,
you know, snizzes on him.
That was a little too on the nose for me, because it's just like spewing pollen at people. I'm like, okay.
Anyway,
so unprotected sex is the font of all
free
natural
love.
Yeah.
Hippies. And immediately
hippies.
And I mean, it's a beautiful scene because
I really can't wait until we get to a third season episode if you want to talk about hippies. But anyway.
I mean, it's this. There's this music playing and the soft lighting and this pretty harmony. And he just says with this astonished voice and, you know, I love you. And then he just stops for a second and says, I can love you. I think that's significant. It's not so much that the breakthrough isn't that Spock loves this woman. Is that suddenly Spock has the ability to love. Spock has become, in a sense, I mean, if you want to talk that Kirk says that, well, the plant makes us less than human, and, you know, being human, according to Spock's, to Kirk's definition, is the highest thing anybody could be. Spock should, by rights, be on these spores all the time, because without them, he's not human.
Yeah, well, I think that's interesting, because, you know, that Star Trek, at least early on, definitely has some, like, speciesism in it.
Yeah.
Because everyone's always ragging on Spock for being a Vulcan and not having, you know, emotions and blah, blah, blah. And he's not human and he should be human. And, you know, oh, his green, his blood is green.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, his kidneys don't exist or whatever. I know Spock has kidneys. Please don't Twitter at me.
Oh, no.
But yeah, I think, like, that's kind of interesting because, yeah, in this episode, Spock, and it's not that Spock doesn't have emotions, because we've seen Spock have emotions before. In The Naked Time, we've seen his emotions come to the forefront. They exist. They exist, full stop. They are there.
Yeah.
It's just that he chooses to repress them. Is that healthy? I don't know. We'll leave that up for further discussion at a later point when the opportunity arises. But in this episode, it's seen as a unalloyed bad thing that his emotions are so out there. And I kind of think that's interesting for early Star Trek, because if it had been true to its roots in making Spock's emotions something to be desirable, that it would have been shot differently. It would have been written differently. It would have been acted differently. As it is, I think it's supposed to make us uncomfortable that Spock has these emotions.
But it didn't. I thought
it makes me uncomfortable.
I don't know. But consider that in light of the very end of the episode. The very last line is, you know, Kirk says, well, you know, Spock, what did you think? And he says, like, all I'm going to say about it, I was happy. Episode ends.
Mm-hmm.
This experience allowed Spock to, for the first and probably only time in his life, experience the emotion of happiness. I really think that Kirk has essentially denied one of his best friends happiness. And for what reason? What is the reason that Kirk decides, well, this is bad?
Because it's not natural.
Why? We're using things from the natural world in order to become further
that's
the natural world.
I'm not saying that I agree with
I know. Yeah, that's like, he doesn't really give a real reason.
No, he doesn't.
If he had said, well, yes, it's, you know, yes, this is, but the people here are developing cancers from this spore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Then you could say, all right, well, this isn't a bad thing. The spore is eventually a parasite. But no, this spore gives perfect health. I mean, hell, why are they using this? I've talked about, you know, we can commercialize this planet before a couple times. But in this case, why the hell aren't we sending terminally ill people to this place for a month for a vacation where they can just have a wonderful month just working at a farm and just chilling out and return with a completely
cured body. And
then,
you know,
body.
At the end of the month, you call their mother a whore, they get upset at you, and then they are happy again.
Basically, like, no, why aren't we doing this? Why is it bad? I really, Kirk, there's the scene where Kirk is in the ship alone and the only buddy, and he's saying, like, I'm all alone, they've all left me. He's terrified. Like I said, that was a very naked old guard reaction.
Yeah, yeah.
Saying, you know, look, there's all this free love, there's this drug culture that we have. Again, remember, this is 66. You know, there are these ideals.
67 by now.
67. There's these anti-war ideals that they have, and each of which is espoused by this colony. And here's Kirk saying, well, that's bad because, you know, duty and discipline and order, and we're not ready. And, you know, it's not natural. And that's very disturbing. Kirk is saying that peace and harmony with the natural world is itself wrong.
Well, I think, okay, so I think there's two things here, and I want to get back to the Spock stuff because I think it's important to get back to the Spock stuff. But in regards to the paradise in this side of paradise and the idea that these people are happy, I don't necessarily think that Kirk is objecting to the fact that these people are happy or that they are in some sort of paradise.
Yeah.
It's a little house on the planet. You know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, it's that kind of thing. I think that he's more objecting to the fact that we got there through means that like modify our chemistry, and we didn't do it ourselves. I think you have to look at it from the point of view that Kirk doesn't like it when people get things that they didn't earn, and Kirk feels that they did not earn paradise.
Has Kirk earned every time McCoy's patched him up or given him a medicine?
I don't know what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, if you talk about something outside the body to give it a state of health or happiness or integrity, I mean, Bones is a doctor who is using chemicals that are outside and using outside weapons to do that. I mean, by the same... It's the same thing. I mean, he's drawing lines just because I believe this is not Kirk's lifestyle.
I don't know. Maybe. I'm not sure. I mean, I really think that that's why Kirk doesn't like it. He doesn't like it because he feels like it's not earned. And he's not objecting to the fact that they're happy. Like, if they move them to another planet that was not bombarding them with these with the radiation that was coming down and was going to kill them in a week.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were happy there. You know, they were growing food,
which is,
you know, was just, they were just growing enough food to survive. I don't think he would really care that much. I mean, he doesn't even mention that. Sulu mentions it. Let's not forget that.
That's true.
I don't think he objects to that. He doesn't object to their lifestyle as much as he objects to the fact that they didn't earn the lifestyle. And I think that's a key difference. I mean, the idea that, you know, Kirk sees... I think you're sort of drawing like a false distinction there where you think that Kirk sees suffering as an unalloyed good. I mean, he doesn't. It's not that, you know, if he breaks his leg, he doesn't want Dr. McCoy to set it for him. No. It's not that kind of thing. And he did kind of earn Dr. McCoy
to
fix his leg because he's the captain.
McCoy
went to medical school. They live in a society. They worked. He is at the pinnacle of technological prowess of this civilization, and they got there through hard work. They didn't get there because a plant spewed some crap in their face. And I think that's the difference.
But at the same time, they're living in he has problems also mentioned with the fact that everyone's so unambitious. But at the same time, why can't they work on that? Why can't they get some botanists to look at this plant and breed a version that doesn't make you so apathetic? One that can give you this happiness and give you a sense of harmony with nature and give one more awareness without the kind of the cap on it.
Why don't they all just smoke pot? Well, I mean, this is like, you know, you could ask these questions all
day. Of course.
And I think, you know, at the end of the day, they could do that, sure. But why? You know, I mean, why would they do that? And then the other thing too, of course, is that, like, you know, Kirk is criticizing them for not having ambition, right? And I think he explicitly says that in the episode.
Yeah.
But you can argue whether or not it's good ambition is good or bad. I don't necessarily think that it's a bad thing that these people don't have ambition to take over the entire planet and, you know, grow enough food to ship off to the Federation. And, you know, I mean, this is sort of like the capitalism, communism debate. Do you just want to have unchecked growth as a good in and of itself? And that's one of the like key criticisms of capitalism is that we don't necessarily need to have growth. It's okay that we just have enough, right? We don't need to get into like a political discussion, but Richard knows my political beliefs and I know his, and you out there don't need to know them. But I think you have to look at it from the point of view that Kirk is a starship captain.
Yeah.
His whole life has been built on ambition. And so for him to see people that have no ambition, yes, you're right. He looks at that as, I don't want to live this way.
Yeah.
And you know what? I think that's a valid objection.
Of course.
Because he's being forced to live in a way that he doesn't want to live.
And I will say, the one thing that the colony does wrong is they don't give a choice. If they had said, you know, look, here's our lifestyle, and yes, we use this plant in order to purge some of the negative aspects which make this kind of lifestyle unsustainable. That being said, you know, while we philosophically value this, you know, certain agrarian, simple life, And they'd given, you know, the people the choice of, you know, do you want this or do you want your regular life? I mean, I can see this being a popular destination for a lot of people.
No, yeah, no, I agree with you.
And I think the choice should have been there. Yes, they're dead wrong to force it on people as they do in the episode. And that's, I think, where the problem is. But that's,
but I think,
the issues of consent are never mentioned.
But I think it's implicit that they're not being given the choice because the plant affects their biochemistry in such a way that they don't have that choice to give someone a choice, right? Like, yeah. They just don't have that ability. Like, they just want everybody to live like they do. And they're almost like zombies or something in some respects. And I think, yes, you could make it as a criticism of the counterculture in that respect where, you know, but I think that that's, you know, I don't know that we can really like analyze it like that because who knows what they were thinking about the counterculture.
Well, that doesn't matter because, you know,
well, I know death of the author and blah, blah, blah.
Just general analysis. I mean, if we had to get a, you know, Roddenberry's word on everything, you know, if we can't make analysis, we have to give DC Fontana a call and figure out what exactly she meant by this. But I mean,
yeah, well, that's true.
For the sake of interpretation, we have to look. And yeah. I'm looking at what's happening contemporaneously to this, and I'm seeing, you know, an anti-war, a back to nature, a free love, a drug culture that they're scared of.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I think, you know, the end of the episode is Kirk's philosophies dominating, and yeah, you can make the argument that that's a bad thing. I think at the end of the day, you object to the choice not being there.
Yeah, and at the end, like I said, the episode.
But I think you have to think about that in terms of Spock, right? Because you mentioned before that, you know, I mean, you didn't say this, but I think I'm getting from you that you think it's a bad thing that Spock had happiness and then had it taken away from him, not being given the choice, right?
Yeah.
But the thing is, Spock makes that choice every day. I think it was a worse thing. Kirk is his friend, and Kirk knows Spock. And he knows that Spock has emotions.
Yeah.
And he knows that Spock chooses to repress them. And chooses to live by this philosophy of logic. So, in effect, Kirk was doing him a favor by giving that choice back to him. If Spock wants to be happy, Spock can be happy.
Okay.
He just has to abandon Vulcan philosophy. That's all he has to do. And he can totally do it. But he doesn't do it. And I think that's the difference that you're missing there.
But then, like I said, the episode just ends on this very ambivalent note because if it's – and that's, I think, why I find it fascinating because it the episode twists on itself several times.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, we have, you know, Kirk giving this great speech where he's saying, you know, we have to earn this, you know, we have ambition, you know, all that. And again, just final line is, you know, I was happy. Keep in mind, I'm an American. Happiness is written as a fundamental right of humanity in our Constitution. It's one of the guiding
principles. No, it's not.
Declaration of Independence?
Yes.
In the Declaration of Independence, it is one of our... I'm an American. I don't know my own history. I was in some dude's house last night. And he had the Constitution above his toilet. And I don't know if he was making a statement or anything like that. But
it wasn't in the toilet, so we'll leave it at that.
Yeah. You know, happiness is seen, at least by the culture in which I live in, and that very same, you know, yes, there's 50 years difference, but, you know, Star Trek came from that very same culture with that very same idea that, you know,
yeah,
happiness and a meaningful life and all of that are something that we should all and can strive for and in a way all deserve.
Yeah. And the Federation is sort of the primacy of, you know, certain subsets of Western cultural values,
yes,
and political values, dominating the entire Earth and then dominating the galaxy. So in that sense, yes, you're dead on.
Yeah. I think the Federation represents at least Roddenberry's idea of ideal of a good government.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Roddenberry always described himself as a humanist. So
yeah,
you can think of it in that respect.
Of course. I just think saying, essentially to me, the episode saying, you know, yes, people should have happiness, but on my terms. You know, these people's happiness, that's an invalid happiness. They need to be happy in this way or nothing.
Yeah, I can see that. I can see that definitely. And
I don't like the episode, but I find it troubling and interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot there that I never thought about before. And, you know, maybe I kind of like this episode now. I'm not sure. But I think you know, you keep mentioning the very last line of the episode where Spock says, I was happy. And yes, I think you can read that in a certain way. You can read that as Kirk taking something from him. But I also think you can read that as Spock being ambivalent about the choice that he's made, because Spock is not a full Vulcan, right? He has human blood in him, and you know, he made that choice, and we'll see this later on that he kind of explicitly made a choice to take on the full Vulcan philosophy and to live as a Vulcan, even though he is half human. And you know, the fact of the matter is, it's difficult for him more so than it is for most Vulcans, because you know, Vulcans, they there's no question about it, that's how their society operates. But the very fact of the matter is, he has a human mother and she loved him and she gave him things that he, Vulcans would not normally get from their parents. And yeah, so he has that in him that had to have had some effect on his psychology. And it's almost like he's doubling down on it. He's really, really Vulcan. Like, he's just really Vulcan. Like, he just wants to be Vulcan so badly. And I think there's a part of him that realizes that he's never going to be happy like that. But it's not relevant that he's not happy.
Maybe. I don't know.
At least to him.
And that's fair. And I mean, we do... It's funny because the more I'm seeing this, I mean, Spock does express emotions, but in very subtle ways. I mean, I don't think that Kirk would like him if Spock never showed loyalty or love or, you know, compassion. And Spock does show all of these things the entire time. He makes no explicit declarations. His face stays blank the entire time. But, you know, Kirk knows him so well at this point that he knows when, you know, Spock is showing how many times does Spock risk his life? You know, I mean, that's an unadorned expression of love and loyalty and sacrifice. Spock does, you know, says, you know, that's logical. That's the right thing to do. That's, you know, what my duty is. But Kirk is still interpreting this at the very least as a human emotion. Maybe it's not what Spock intended, but that's what allows the two of them to be friends.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. Totally. And I think, you know, there's a wryness to Spock, and there's a sort of like a sarcastic edge to Spock. And, you know, he definitely does exhibit those kind of things, and whether or not he's playing them off or not, I mean, you know, dogs don't smile, but they look like they smile.
Yeah.
And I'm not comparing Spock to a dog, but
no. But
you know,
I mean,
and I think there's a sense that, you know, and maybe I'm going to say something controversial here, maybe not, that Vulcans are boring. They're boring. And, you know, there's a reason why, there's two reasons why, like, Star Trek shows after Star Trek shied away from having a Vulcan as a main cast member. Number one, because of the shadow of the original series and Spock.
Yeah.
Well, you know, let's put that out there. But number two, because they're just not that interesting. And I don't particularly like the post original series portrayal of Vulcans. I think that we haven't really,
I don't think I've ever seen any
Vulcans yet other than Spock. Okay. But there's definitely a sense of mysticism to Vulcans in the original series. There's a sense of mystery to Vulcans in the original series. And there's a sense that they have a very rich culture and a very interesting culture that they've developed in absence of emotions, that is fulfilling psychologically, personally, mentally, fills some need in them as a society and as people. And I think that later on in the later shows, Vulcans just become logic robots and all of that kind of goes away. Yeah. And I think it's very unfortunate.
I mean, I always got the sense that...
But that's kind of a side tangent.
I get the sense that Vulcan culture is, you know, Vulcan art is similar to how I perceive opera, for example. I can see how it's, you know, technically interesting and, you know, aesthetically beautiful, but I find it extremely... It never stirs me. I assume that's how, you know, there's a philosophically aesthetic, you know, appreciation that exists, but not a love.
Yeah, exactly. And there's definitely aspects to their culture that what we'll see in a few weeks. I'm specifically thinking about a very early season two episode, which is our first glimpse into Vulcan society, like full Vulcan society.
Oh boy.
Which is a really good episode. So look forward to that.
One thing about this episode we haven't mentioned, and I feel very remiss in not saying it, even though it's just kind of funny. McCoy is fucking awesome.
That's his
episode.
Real accent, you know.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
That is Montgomery. What's his? Oh God, why do I not remember his name? DeForest Kelly. My God, I'm so sorry. Yeah, that's DeForest Kelly's real accent. Yeah, that was not a put on.
No, that was awesome because he just turns into like this country doctor, and one of the best scenes is, you know, Kirk comes in and he's like, "What's going on?" And Spock's like, "Well, he went off to make something called a mint julep."
Yeah, and he's just like,
"What's a drink, Jim?"
He's just like sitting under a tree drinking a mint julep,
and I have to say, you know, you say that this is a colony that doesn't work. What pisses McCoy off is when the other guy says, "All right, well, it's time to get to work, man." And Bones is like, "I'm a doctor and I have a mint julep. You know, I'm just going to my work. I'm going to fix." And he's like, "Well, we don't need a doctor. So go to work." He's like, "I have a fucking mint julep. I'm going to drink this guy." And, you know, it's alcohol, which gets his ire up.
Yep. Exactly. I, in all this talk of, you know, Vulcans and happiness. Oh my God, McCoy in this episode. Yes, he's great.
I would hang out with McCoy the entire time. We just,
yeah.
And I, to cap it. You know, it doesn't even just that he's sitting under a tree and he has a mint julep. He takes a piece of grass and just puts it in his mouth, like, just to complete the picture. All he needs is a hat.
He's an old Kentucky boy. I mean, that's it, right? Like, and that's the thing, right? Like, I think, you know, it's funny and I like that moment and I like McCoy in this episode. But, like, it really, I think, it, you know, maybe that's another reason why I don't particularly, you know, this episode kind of strikes me as a little creepy because... The people on the planet, like, they keep saying they're happy and they keep saying they're content and, like, all this kind of stuff, but they don't really ever seem to have that much fun, and they're all just kind of like, yeah, well, we farm and, you know, we're all in perfect health and, you know.
I assume there's a lot of sex going on.
I don't know. Is there?
You have a bunch of people in perfect health with little to do, and they're pretty.
But the jumpsuits, Richard, they're not
flattering. Easy access.
I guess. But McCoy seems like the only person who's having any fun.
I feel like Yahur is the only one who creeped me out, by the way. Like, everyone else, I'm like, all right, you know, and, you know, maybe I've just been around more people on drugs than you have, Ben, you know. But Yahur is like, yes, Captain, I've destroyed it, Captain. There's no community. And just like, oh, God, she's creepy. Everyone else is just like a little, just really relaxed.
Yeah.
It's like they all just took a couple Xanax.
Yeah. All right, so is there anything else you want to discuss about this side of paradise?
I don't believe so, but I would give it 9 tribbles.
9? Wow.
I really liked watching it.
I think before our conversation, I would give it a 5. I think after our conversation, I still give it a 5, but with an asterisk.
Ah. See me after class.
See me after class, yes. Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so... I was a little remiss because many, many episodes ago, we were talking about gender politics. And, well, we talked about it.
I would say, don't we talk about them in, like, this is the first episode we haven't.
We talk about it a lot. I don't think we've talked about it in a few episodes. But on the Trek BBS, someone said something about our discussions of gender politics, especially in regards to the first episodes we did, The Cage and Where No Man Has Gone Before. Which I wanted to share with all of you and perhaps get some reaction from Richard, because I think there's some interesting things there that we could talk about.
I don't really want to talk about The Cage or Where Man Has Gone Before, because those were awful.
I don't know his real name. his handle on the Trek BBS is Maurice. And there's, I believe that his avatar is a picture of him with Ronald Moore. So that's good for him. Ron Moore worked for Deep Space Nine, wrote for Voyager a little bit, and wrote a few episodes of The Next Generation, I believe, and created the Battlestar Galactica remake. Just so you know who you're dealing with.
I thought that was the guy who was James Bond in like a movie.
It was also him. Yeah, he's very old.
He's lived a really interesting
life. He has. Also, he was president of the Czech Republic for 4 months in 1992.
No, that was Václav Havel.
Oh, man. I always get those two mixed up. So he says that he thinks that we confuse the gender politics of the time and of the cage with Roddenberry's own ideas about women. And he says that not all TV shows of the period portrayed competent women as non-feminine. So I have two thoughts about this.
Wait, sorry. He says not all.
Not all television shows of the 60s portrayed competent women as non-feminine.
So in other words, there were TV shows which portrayed feminine competent women.
Yes.
Okay.
I asked him for some follow up on that. I haven't heard back, so I'm just going to yell at him. I'm not going to yell at you. Okay. There's two things here. Number one is by Roddenberry's ideas about women. I'm not sure what he means because. Roddenberry was an inveterate womanizer, and it's well known that he was a womanizer. Majel Barrett and he were married for many years, and he cheated on her a lot with many women, many, many women.
I take it something she was not okay with.
Was
it cheating or an open relationship? Because that's a different thing.
It's kind of half and half. I mean, you know, she doesn't really talk about it that much.
Because she's dead.
It's painful for her. I mean, there was a movie that their son made. I believe his name was Eugene Roddenberry, although I'm not confident of that because I'm a bad Trekkie. Which I also don't remember the name of because I'm a bad Trekkie, and also I didn't prepare at all for this. Which came out last year, and he talks about his experiences with the franchise. And how he wasn't a fan and, you know, he sort of stayed away from it when he was a kid because his dad was involved in it and all this kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, he and his dad had a bad relationship and
that could be interesting.
You know, after he died, Star Trek saved his life or whatever. Yeah. He felt closer to his father after he got more involved in Star Trek after Gene Roddenberry died. It's good. It's a good movie. I would recommend it. I watched it a few months ago. But in that he does talk a little bit about, Gene Roddenberry's womanizing ways. And he says that it hurt his mother very deeply. It wasn't anything that she ever really talked about. They obviously stayed married until he died. And it wasn't really anything that I think, you know, we don't know what Gene Roddenberry thought about it. So that was the first thing that I thought about when he talked about, you know, mentioned Roddenberry's views on women. The second thing is, I don't know what Roddenberry's views on women were. I looked. I don't really see anything. I mean, apart from his general ideas about women being equal to men and more, you know, as competent as men. And yes, he did put number one on the bridge of the Enterprise in the cage. A woman playing the number two in command. The network did not want that. But I think we have to look at the fact that, you know, like we said many, many episodes ago, number one, while a competent woman was not feminized at all, and I disagree with this guy strongly that he says that, you know, in the 60s, women could be viewed as both competent and feminine. It did not happen.
Think about like Get Smart. Agent 99 is number one, a much better agent than anybody is. And she's played by the very pretty Barbara Felton. She's in miniskirts. Like, you have, what's her name? The Avengers.
You have Avengers, Emma Peel.
Diana Rigg. All of the women in the Avengers, really. Again, confident and sexy as hell. Let me think.
That's the thing. Aside from those two very specific examples,
I wouldn't consider that a representative sample only because I don't consider myself a scholar of TV. It's one of those.
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm not thinking about it because I'm not familiar enough with it, or if there isn't as much to be found. So
I don't know.
I would be interested in hearing some more authoritative evidence on that. So if listeners, if any of you can give a idea about, you know, that, you know, if you can name me some examples of competent women in the 60s, television. That would be great.
Yeah, we would both like to hear it. I mean, I thought about it, and you know, I don't know as much about 60s television as I do about, you know, later decades.
Yeah.
You know, most of my I don't really watch a lot of dramas from that period because I mostly find them unwatchable, except for Star Trek, obviously. I've seen, you know, a lot of sitcoms from that period, and I can't really say that, you know, there were all that many competent feminine women in sitcoms of the 60s. There weren't.
And the Mary Tyler Moore Show isn't incompetent.
She's not incompetent, but she's also, you know, she's a housewife.
Yeah, I was going to say. I mean,
I think, you know, the idea that, yes, women can be competent and feminine is something that we, you know, most people would subscribe to nowadays, you know, 50 years later. There's a difference between, you know, what we were talking about and what perhaps, yes, you can be competent and feminine as a housewife. You can be competent and feminine as a secretary,
a nurse,
a teacher, like these kind of professions totally be competent and feminine at the same time. But if you're talking about a man's job, you had to be, you had to tamp your feminism down.
Yeah. And interesting that in both cases that we did find, they're secret agents, such a fantasy profession, really.
It's a fantasy profession, and also, you know, it was a male profession, and it was an action, you know, power, you know, of body and of mind. I mean, you know, these are
Diana Rigg is in cat suits as much because it allows her to be action and much because we want to see Diana Rigg in a cat suit. There is that.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if you can show me tons of examples from 60s shows of competent and feminine female doctors, female lawyers, female test pilots, you know, female train conductors, many, many things like that, you know, female politicians. Please, I would love to hear them, but I just don't think they're out there. I really don't.
Maybe we'll see a few psychoanalysts. I mean, that's
yeah, that's about it.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, if anybody out there, you know, does disagree with you know, our interpretation of gender politics of the 60s and thinks we're wrong, but, you know, send us examples or tell us why we're wrong. Yeah, I guess Twitter, Eric Brazier. If you want to give your Twitter.
I don't really use it, but you can visit my band's website at riotfox.bandcamp.com.
Apparently we're plugging things now.
Why not?
If you want to go visit my site and download my video game podcast, go do that. Why are we doing this? I don't know.
Why aren't we doing this?
I don't know.
Cross-marketing.
Cross-marketing.
Buy Dole bananas. They're delicious.
Yeah.
Please don't buy Dole bananas. They kill, like, Native Hawaiians or something like that. Isn't that really, aren't they really bad?
Yeah, like, probably. I don't know. I don't eat bananas. I don't like bananas. And also, it would really, really help us now that we, this is our 12th episode, believe it or not. If you've been listening and enjoying it, please go to iTunes and, rate us and write a review, please. It would really help the show. I would give you a cookie if you did it.
Aww.
I would love you to do that. So, please do that.
Can I have a cookie?
No.
Why don't I ever get cookies?
Because I don't like you, Richard.
I'm gonna get my own cookies.
Yeah. Get your own cookies. And I'm sorry. I said that thing about not liking you.
Too bad. Now I'm not, I was going to get cookies for you, but now not going to happen.
Will you be around next week for The Devil in the Dark and Errand of Mercy?
Well, probably.
Okay, good. Good. Okay. So we're still on for that?
Yes.
Okay, good. Yeah. So next week, join us for discussions of The Devil in the Dark and Errand of Mercy. See you then.